So it's my pleasure to introduce Doug Thorpe, professor and writer. At least one book in the store, right? If not two books in the store. So I want to look for those. And he's talking about The Promised Land. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. And thank you all for coming. 4 o'clock on a Monday, beautiful Monday afternoon after there's a lot of smoke in the valley. So this is great that you're here. Does everybody have one of the handouts? Do you need a copy of this? I also noted that this is one of the 3 hours that the bookstore is open today. So in particular, I'm impressed that you would choose to hear about The Promised Land instead of hang out at the bookstore. In certain ways, I feel like, to me, there's a wonderful book ending that happens today and on a couple of other days. My day more or less started with hearing from Wes and Sue, and there are certain ways this is going to be a continuation or a midrash, perhaps, on what they did. In fact, I'm going to start with pretty close to what they started with, Deuteronomy 7. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are about to enter and occupy, and he clears away many nations before you, and I'm not sure what the Hebrew is there, but that's pretty striking language in the English translation.
Nations?
When he clears away. When he clears away the nations. I mean, it's sort of a euphemism, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about ethnic cleansing, basically. When he clears away the nations before you, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations mightier and more numerous than you, and when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must utterly destroy them, make no covenant with them, and show them no mercy. And Wes and Sue were juxtaposing that passage with Matthew 5, and it's a really striking contrast, of course. Welcome. And one of the questions that they were raising is, well, how do we determine what's right, what's true? And one of the things I want to do, this is an introduction to three sessions where we're going to be exploring this idea of Promised Land. Israel, Palestine, and the United States, because of course the United States has inherited that language really profoundly, and I think that there are beautiful ways that we have inherited that. There's something very powerful about this concept of the Promised Land, but I think there's also a shadow side to it, and so I want to be exploring both aspects of that. One quote that I'll probably begin, more or less begin each session with, is from James Baldwin, an essay called The Price of the Ticket. Baldwin writes, "In the church I come from, which is not at all the same church to which white Americans belong, we were counseled from time to time to do our first works over. Go back to where you started, or as far back as you can. Examine it. Examine all of it. Travel your road again and tell the truth about it. Sing or shout or testify or keep it to yourself, but know whence you came. Know whence you came." And I take Baldwin to mean two things there. One is, historically, where do you come from? What is the truth? What do we know about the facts of where we come from? And our history, of course, that includes practical genocide, it includes slavery. I mean, the facts of our founding, those are part of the facts of our founding, along with the Declaration of Independence, the Civil Rights Movement, and so on. So there are actual facts of the history. But there's also the vision. When he says, know whence you came, I think he's also talking about what vision inspired you. Where do you come from in terms of your idea, your ideals? And in a way, these three sessions are an opportunity for me to do a lot of that retracing. So you're going to get a little William Blake, because a lot of my roots as a scholar, as an academic, are in William Blake. Even before that, as I was thinking about this session and thinking about this question of how do you know what's true, what's right, I found myself going back to one of the great American texts of the 19th century, Huckleberry Finn. And I use the story with students quite often. I teach at Seattle Pacific University, which is a Free Methodist institution. It's theologically conservative. Many of our students come from very conservative backgrounds, evangelical backgrounds, at times fundamentalist backgrounds. And they go on a journey through those 4 years, right? Especially English majors. It's not an English mod. That's part of what we do. I could almost use the language that came out of my dissertation. I read a lot of Paul Ricoeur on theories of metaphor for my dissertation. And Ricoeur talks about the parables as disorienting in order to reorient. Right? And that's a lot, I think, of what happens in college. Right? And so students end up in a place where they no longer know exactly what's true, what's right, what to believe in. And sometimes I'll use the story of Huckleberry Finn. Probably everybody here at some point read Huckleberry Finn. Okay. Famous scene. Huck is on the river, on the Mississippi, with Jim. And Jim is trying to escape slavery into freedom. Huck is in a quandary. Should he help Jim? Should he not help Jim? Everything in his culture, everything he knows about the Bible from his culture in the Deep South, everything from his family, his education, has taught him one thing, that it is illegal to help a slave escape from slavery, and it is immoral, it is a sin, and you will be condemned for it. That's what Huck knows. What else does Huck know? Anybody answer that question? What else does Huck know? Because there is something else.
That Jim's a good guy.
He knows Jim, yeah.
Exactly. He knows Jim. He knows Jim. What does he know about Jim?
Jim was his friend.
Jim was his friend. More, Jim was a father figure to him. Huck really had no father. There's a relationship between the two of them. That's what Huck knows. And we use that word know. What does it mean, right? What does it mean that Huck knows this about Jim? He knows an experience of love through his relationship with Jim. That's the tension that Huck is facing. Does he go with what he has learned, what his family has taught him, what is deeply inbred in him as a Southern boy? Or does he go with this actual experience with Jim? The answer, of course, from our point of view culturally, 100, 150 years later, right, is to probably agree with Huck. When Huck says, finally, okay, I'll go to hell, he means that. He thinks he's helping Jim escape from slavery, he's condemning him. Right? Our response to that, of course, is to applaud. It's one of the great moments in English literature, precisely for that experience. And I love that moment, and it's a teachable moment, right, where I invite my students. It's the question, what do you know? What do you know? You go deep into your heart, go deep into your body. What do you know to be true? Have you experienced love? From family, from friends, from a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a dog, a cat, from the mountains. What do you know to be true, and how do you know it? That's the fundamental question. And that was a huge question for me growing up. I was raised Presbyterian, but it was very lukewarm. Suburbs of Chicago, 1960s. My father was village attorney of Oak Park, right on the western edge of Chicago. And what that meant was, this is the late 1950s and 1960s, it's the civil rights movement. There's a lot of white flight. And my father, as a village attorney, is in the middle of all that. And what my father tried to do was to find a way to open Oak Park racially. And there was a lot of grief around that. A lot of grief around that. For me, the church was not part of that experience. The church was not alive to me. So what was I doing? I was listening to a lot of music. It's the 1960s. I'm reading. And I'm mostly trying to answer these questions on my own. One of the first places I went was to William Blake. I started reading Blake in high school, studied him more seriously in college, went to graduate school, did a graduate seminar on Blake with one of the great Blake scholars in the country, a guy named Edward Adams, which led to a dissertation. And central to that work on Blake was Blake's long epic poem called Jerusalem. And so that's the beginning, in some ways, of my interest in the idea of Jerusalem, what Jerusalem means. And so I thought I would at least give you this short poem, which is certainly one of the most famous passages in Blake. Many of you will know it as a hymn. Is it familiar? And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains? Do you have any singers here? Anybody recognize the hymn? And did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pasture seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark Sabbatic hills? Bring me my bow of burning gold, bring me my arrows of desire, bring me my spear, O clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease a mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have filled Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. If you've seen the movie Chariots of Fire, that's where the plot comes from. So this is a preface to a long epic poem of Blake's, which we don't need to get into. It was set to music many decades after Blake wrote this. Blake was writing this in the early part of the 19th century. One of the ironies is that this poem set to music has become an unofficial national anthem for England. Right? That is, it has become a highly patriotic song in England. Right? To affirm England's national pride. Right? And putting it in terms of Wesson Sue, right? For Blake, this is a poem from the religion of creation. And as a hymn, it became a poem of empire. It's one of the great ironies for Blake. So what is he saying here? Well, there was a real question. There was a legend that in those years that we don't know anything about Jesus' life, that he may actually have gone all the way to England, or that Joseph of Arimathea went to England and brought Christianity. And so Blake is playing with this idea. Not that he takes it literally historically, but figuratively. Metaphorically, this idea of Jesus in England. Right? And what would it mean? How do we bring this figure, this person, this reality, this idea, however you understand Jesus, to England? Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. literal or figurative, these arrows? Is he talking about real arrows? Absolutely. Arrows of desire, energy, you know, power, creative energy is what he's saying. This is what we need. Hence the spear and so on, bringing my chariot of fire. So he's taking militaristic language, using it figuratively. If you think about the letter to the Ephesians, you've got similar kinds of language, as the footnote would indicate. So taking over, subverting, reorienting this kind of language. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand. In the context, we recognize when he's talking about the sword and the hand, again, this is figurative, as all of this is. Till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. The big question, what does that mean? What does it mean to build Jerusalem? And so clearly, this is not about a literal building. This is about bringing what Jerusalem represents, what Jerusalem means. And again, Blake, well aware of Book of Revelations, chapters 21, 22, New Heavens and New Earth, New Jerusalem. Blake was deeply indebted to that language and the language of Isaiah. The footnote here sets up the comparison, right? This notion of, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand. The footnote says, when Jerusalem was rebuilt after the captivity, only half the people worked while the other half stood guard with weapons. And quote, the builders, every one who had his sword girded by his side, and so builded. And this is, but again, I'm thinking, if we're looking at Ezra and Nehemiah, right, religion of empire or religion of creation. Right? We're looking at religion of empire. Right? I pulled out the New Oxford Annotated, for just a quick hit on Ezra and Nehemiah, looking at the introduction. During the exile, religious interest had concentrated particularly on the laws associated with the name of Moses, and had fostered the exclusiveness which became so characteristic of a certain style of Judaism. Thus, the returned exiles were concerned not only with the literal reconstruction of altar, temple, and city, but with social and religious problems, freeing the community of foreign elements, establishing religious practice in stricter conformity to their understanding of Mosaic law. To the author, the returned exiles were a godly remnant with a religious mission. You can take that language, you can apply it to the religious orthodoxy in Israel right now. You can apply it to the settlements, especially the settlements with the Orthodox, with the strongly religious, and it's very much the same. There were issues of purity, for one thing. Who you could marry and who you could not marry. So it was, as I was thinking about the Blake, and just pulling a copy of Blake from our library here and finding that footnote to Nehemiah, it was like, okay, we're walking in the same territory. All right. If Blake was a significant influence for me, going back even earlier in high school, I was talking about being raised Presbyterian, but not finding a lot of life in that. Where I found life was in music. And in particular, discovering Bob Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited in June of 1966. I was 13 years old. I have no idea what led me to a song like Desolation Row as a 13-year-old. My mother was unhappy. It's like I'm sitting in my room listening, you know. Yeah, what is it? The postcards? We're painting the passports brown. It's
circuit for the tale. Here comes the blind commissioner. I'm in a trance. I mean, said our meal. Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the captain's tower. It's a strange and wonderful song. And as a 13-year-old, I was fascinated. I remember seeing the jacket, looking at the back of the jacket, and seeing the song that's 11 minutes long. Desolation Row. So here's another quote. That I read some years ago and has always stayed with me. Here's a quote. First time I recognized the country I lived in, the truest version I heard was when I put on Bob Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited, Bruce Springsteen told the reporter. That was it. That's what it feels like, Springsteen said. And now, watching the first Obama inauguration. There it is again, he says. Quote, it's a particular place I've imagined. It shows its face. You looked in the crowds, you saw people crying, people who lived and worked in the civil rights era, and you completely understood it's real. It's not just something I dreamed up. It can exist. That was Springsteen's response. Of course, he was at that. He performed at that inauguration. So my question is, what is the it that he is referring to? The first time I recognized the country I lived in is one answer to that. The truest version I heard was when I put on Highway 61. I went, that's it. So there's that. Then, now, watching the inauguration, there it is again. What is it that he's seeing, experiencing? Can we put words to that? It's two different examples. He's connecting the two, and they're curious in terms of the connection. So what is it? Yeah, what is it? Is it that he is hearing? What is it he's experiencing in the Obama inauguration?
Is it the vision or the goal of, in this case, a black president, perhaps? Something that is maybe unheard of that all of a sudden has come to be?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly that would be one way of encapsulating it.
Yeah.
Well, president. Yeah.
I think on that line, but it's sort of the most dispossessed, right? If you think of Jerusalem, it depends which way, if you look at the more Judaic version versus the Christian version, but I think it's, if you're supposed to have the most dispossessed be able to sit on parity with essentially the most powerful, to see an ocean of people, very multicolored, and to have someone representing the most dispossessed at some point in this country, the president, I think that that's, that the possibility that that kind of opportunity exists is the it, right? Like, that you can sail across the ocean and you can be the most dispossessed, but you still have something here.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and we'll touch again on this on Wednesday, while we'll be looking primarily using the Moses story and the Exodus story, the way that it translates in terms of Israel-Palestine, but then also it was such a hugely important story in America. So we'll be playing with that, certainly. Yeah. I mean, what Springsteen says is, it's a particular place I've imagined. What is that place? Again, it's all metaphorical.
Well, Springsteen, he didn't even have a song about the Promised Land.
Yes, yeah, he references the Promised Land in many songs. I was joking, we were hiking yesterday, my wife and daughter, and I was joking, oh, I should just scrap everything I'm doing and I'll just do Bruce on the Promised Land.
Well, make you think of the King's Speech. We will get to the Promised Land.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, the mountaintop.
The mountaintop.
The mountaintop. I've seen it. I've seen it. That amazing speech. right at the end of his life. A place I've imagined. You look in the crowd, you saw people crying, people who lived and worked in the civil rights era, and you completely understood it's real. All of that.
Yeah. You connect other images. My mind conjures up Hicks's The Peaceable Kingdom, you know, where it's a place, and lions are lying down with lambs, and it's and at that inauguration, there was a lot of mixing. There wasn't just here's the blacks and here's the whites. There was a lot of togetherness in the crowd.
Yeah, yeah. And that's partly, and we have such a short period of time this week. We have 3 hours, really. But I encourage you to be thinking about this image and finding where have I found that place? And for some people, Holden is, you know, close to it at moments as a village. Where have I found that place?
Yeah. Following up on that, I guess I'm just kind of wondering, does each culture or tradition perhaps have their own, and then when you bring them all together, where the overlaps were is the polarization, perhaps. You know, my version is different than your version of the Promised Land.
Yeah.
Is that where conflict comes?
Yeah, and certainly part of the conflict is that we may well have different versions. Again, I was thinking about this. I was thinking about Obama and what I take to be, you know, a certain aspect of Obama's vision, King's vision. And of course, comparing it, you know, what is Trump's, you know, mountaintop experience? You know? It's a different vision of what, if we're just thinking about America, right? Who are we? Right? That's this big question. Who are we? What is the vision that we have? Yeah.
Just going to add, just to make me think of this, I know it's totally apropos, but as we learned in the Australian Indigenous traditions, as I'm sure many people know, that each group has their storyline, their narrative, their relationship with the place they call home and how they got there. One of the things that fascinated me is if two different groups' storylines intersect, the stories intersect about your place, and that means they have shared responsibility for that place, where their stories intersect over that place.
Interesting, and part of my vision is the intersection, right? Is where our stories intersect. There's something about that that I love the idea of it, and when I'm able to experience it, whether it's racial or cultural, whatever, right? I mean, that's the America that I occasionally glimpse. I live in Seattle. We have a folklife festival over Memorial Day weekend, and people from all over the city are coming, and there's, you know, all different kinds of music, food, and it's just this great kind of festival of who we are, right? The best of what a city is. And I'm from the Chicago area, you know, and we experience that going downtown Chicago. So there's something extraordinary about that vision, right? But clearly not everybody shares that vision. So the other thing is that, and I'm thinking about Springsteen's comment about the Obama inauguration. I happened to be in Nazareth the night of the inauguration, which was a very powerful experience. I was on my first trip to Israel-Palestine. It was with an environmental, Christian environmental group called Earth Ministry. And we are looking at environmental issues in the Holy Land, especially water issues. And I was sitting in a hotel room with my good friend Carla Prine, who has been here many times, watching CNN from a hotel room in Nazareth, watching this astonishing celebration. And it was like this coming together of these different stories. I found myself thinking, you know, famously, if we're thinking Nazareth, Luke 4, right? Jesus, filled with the power of the Spirit, returned to Galilee, and a report about him spread through the surrounding country. He began to teach in their synagogues, was praised by everyone up to a certain point,
When he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll, found the place where it was written, quote, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." He rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, sat down. The eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. Then he began to say to them, "Today the scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." It's like, make a great scene in the movie. It's amazing. Like, quoting Isaiah, right? Taking over that prophetic lineage and saying, I embody that. Right? And so thinking of those lines, being in Nazareth, your bond and liberation, it felt there was just possibility in the air. It's like, this place that I've imagined seems to be coming to life. People in Israel have felt that. They felt that. 1948, the declaration of the state. I can't even begin to imagine how powerful that was for people a few years out of the Holocaust.
Yeah. So it's the Jews you're talking about.
Yes.
Not the Palestinians.
Well,
whose land it was.
We're going to get there. Trust me. Right. For a brief moment, I just want to sit with what it felt like from the Jewish side. I'll give you an example. It's a bit of a digression, but I'm hearing what you're feeling. Right? There's a wonderful Palestinian Christian activist, Samuel Watt, some of you may know, lives and works in Bethlehem, Holy Land Trust. Samuel Watt has spent his life working for, on behalf of the Palestinian people through nonviolent activism. Some years ago, having heard, of course, all of his life stories of the Holocaust, right, which was not about his people, he decided he had to go to Auschwitz to try to experience from inside the Jewish life something about that, so he could begin to empathize. So by analogy, I'm just for a moment trying to recognize what that felt like. And this goes back, the history of Zionism, don't have time to go into it, but this goes back to the late 19th century and through 1917, the Balfour Declaration, where England, which was controlling that land at the end of World War I, taking it over from the Ottoman Empire, the Balfour Declaration said in 1917, England is in favor of a Jewish state. And from then until 1948, the working towards that, and the extraordinary feeling of scripture being fulfilled. It was for many people, there was something apocalyptic about this possibility. I want to quote from Ari Shavit, who is an Israeli Zionist. He would be called a progressive Zionist, but a Zionist, right? That is, a believer in the state of Israel as a Jewish state. He wrote a book a couple years ago called My Promised Land. And he's talking about his land and his own understanding of that land. He writes, "In the autumn of 1957, the city I am born in, Rehovot, is getting ready to inaugurate a nuclear physics department. At the very same time, Tel Aviv's new performing arts center is opened. Arthur Rubinstein, Isaac Stern, Leonard Bernstein came to 9-year-old Israel to celebrate with the fine musicians and enthusiastic audience of the Israeli Philharmonic."
The national project of draining the swamps of Lake Hula in the Galilee is completed. The first supermarket is set to open in Tel Aviv. This is a celebration of 1957, 9 years after the founding of the state. But then Shabbat goes on to write this. But the miracle of the Promised Land is based on denial. The nation I am born into has erased Palestine from the face of the earth. Bulldozers razed Palestinian villages, razed as an R-A-Z-E-D. Warrants confiscated Palestinian land, laws revoked Palestinian citizenship, annulled their homeland. By the socialist kibbutz Ayin Harod lie the ruins of the Palestinian village Humya. By the orange groves of my own city, Rehovot, lie the remains of two Palestinian villages. In the middle of Israeli Lida, the debris of Palestinian Lida is all too apparent. And yet there seems to be no connection in people's mind between these sites and the people who occupied them a decade earlier, 10 years. 10-year-old Israel has expunged Palestine from its memory and soul. When I am born, my grandparents, my parents, their friends go about their lives as if the other people never existed, as if they were simply driven out, as if the other people aren't languishing right now in the refugee camps of Jericho, Dehesha, Jabalia, and so forth. This is an Israeli Zionist writing this. So this is, again, this contrast between Promised Land, which some people are experiencing in Israel, and yet the reality. And what we will see, and this is not news, I think pretty much everybody sitting here, right? That language applies to our country as well, in very specific ways. 10 years, right? The memory. Part of the way that happened was through renaming. Right. Already in 1948, David Ben-Gurion, who became prime minister, right, established a committee of geographers to rename Palestinian villages and sites from Arabic and turning them into Hebrew. Usually finding some kind of biblical reference somewhere near this geographical location that they could plug into that location and label it as an Old Testament site. Right. So literally the names were expunged. Well, where are we? Holden Village, Martin Ridge. Who's Martin? I mean, we did that over and over again. Mount Rainier, Puget Sound, and so on and so forth. So, one of the places that I went to, the second time I went over, I've been over three times, and I'll be over again in about 3 weeks, actually, less than that, in about a week, actually. A place called Ten of Nations. I'm not sure if any of you been down Nasser, Ten of Nations, spent time over Israel, Palestine. I know last week you know talked a little bit about that. Yeah. What do you remember?
I was just there in January, February. What's the proximal location of that?
It's actually not far from Bethlehem.
Oh, okay.
Just a few miles from Bethlehem.
Probably went through the Bethlehem.
It's in the West Bank, yeah. Mm-hmm. So where all did you go?
Jerusalem, a lot of the area around the Sea of Galilee.
Yeah.
And Bethlehem, Nazareth, down in the Dead Sea area.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, Ten of Nations is in the West Bank, and it is surrounded by settlements. And if you follow this at all. The Israeli settlements tend to be placed on hilltops. And it just so happens that the Nasser property, Dawood Nasser's property, which is called Ten of Nations, has a commanding view, let's put it that way. It's on a hilltop, surrounded by Israeli settlements. And since 1991, the Israeli government has been trying to claim that land as state land. Okay, so 1991, that takes us 27 years, something like that. Right? So Dawood and his family have been in the Israeli courts for 27 years, fighting against this. And the reason that Israel has not been able to take the land is because in 1916, over 100 years ago, Dawood's grandfather actually signed formal papers with deeds to that property. Very unusual for Palestinian farmers at the time. You knew which property was yours simply by, because you had neighbors that had been there a long time, centuries quite often. But Dawood's grandfather actually had papers going back to the Ottoman Empire. And Israel has not been able to simply ignore that fact. It's gone all the way to the Israeli Supreme Court. So there's a story that Dawood often tells he's working his land. He's got olive trees, many, many different kinds of fruit trees on this property. He has about 100 acres. So he's on his tractor cultivating a plot of land very close to one of the bordering settlements. He's approached by a young man, probably about 17 or 18 years old, carrying a semi-automatic rifle. This is one of the kids from the settlement, right, who comes up to him. Right. The boy comes up to Dawood. He's carrying this rifle. He comes up to Dawood and says, "What are you doing on our land?" Right? It's obviously Dawood's property, right? He's cultivating it. "What are you doing on our land?" Right. Dawood says, "This is my land." The boy, "No, it is ours." The farmer looks at the boy and says, "My grandfather bought this land over 100 years ago. We have the papers to prove it." The boy looks at Dawood, points a finger to the sky, and says, "It's our land. We have papers from God. We have papers from God." Yeah. And that's where the tension is. Who's right? Who's right? If we had more time, we could explore some of the questions about. Because obviously the boy is going back to these primary texts in the book of Genesis, right? Statements from Yahweh giving the land to Abraham. Although the context often is, define this, Genesis 15, Genesis 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great." And I love that in contrast to the Nehemiah passage, where they're rebuilding the temple and, you know, with their swords handy, right? "I will be your shield." Abram said, "O Lord God, what will you give me, for I continue childless?" And Abram said, "You have given me no offspring." And then, "But the word of the Lord came to him, 'This man shall not be your heir. No one but your very own issue shall be your heir.'
Look toward heaven, count the stars, if you're able to count them. Then he said, so shall your descendants be. And he believed the Lord, and the Lord reckoned it to him as righteousness. Reckoned it to him as righteousness. I was checking a couple of the commentaries, and this is where I was going to turn to Wes and see if he has anything to add to this. But the commentaries note that Abraham is not finding favor in the sight of God because Abraham is following the law, following the cult or whatever. That it's this righteousness, that he has a, the way it's interpreted, at least in the commentaries I looked at, was that he has a right attitude, to be the way of putting it. Right? That he is aligned in a certain way. Okay? So it's that attitude that tends to take a particular focus in Genesis. I think we're going there probably tomorrow.
Back to that passage from Genesis.
Yeah, Genesis.
Sure. Yeah.
Genesis. And so, this tension about we have papers from God as opposed to I have legal papers. Part of the irony is that Daoud is the one with the legal papers. Right? And Daoud, in that sense, is relying on laws going back to England and theories of John Locke in the 17th century about property. Right? And again, if we had time, we could kind of go into some of that. Right? But it was John Locke who was influential on the creation of the Declaration of Independence and American ideas about the importance of property. Right? Individual ownership. And Daoud is relying on that. Right? And he's cultivating his land. Much of the argument that the settlers made, you know, the first European settlers in this country made in terms of claiming land in this country had to do with, well, these Indians, these Native Americans, these savages, they don't cultivate the land. They were following theories of John Locke, that ownership is really through using the land, developing the land, improving the land, making the desert bloom is the language. That's exactly the argument that has been used in Palestine. Oh, the Palestinians. They're not using the land. There are specific quotes you have from settlers, again, up on these hilltops, who said, we didn't take anybody's land. They weren't using this. And then you talk to one of the Palestinian villagers, who says, of course, you know, I graze my animals, I've planted olive trees, and so on. So it's the same argument that was used in both circumstances. So what we're seeing is a repetition, really, of American history being played out in a very short time frame in Israel-Palestine. We have about, question.
I'm curious, though, to be analogous with American Indian treaties for someone who's actually also using a legal basis for an Aboriginal place of origin, concurrent with the Palestinians, that you can make an argument too. You know, he was a descendant of that area for an extended period of time,
sure,
using a legal argument similar to a treaty.
Yeah,
tribes. You know, I mean, you're kind of playing both ends, but they are quote unquote promises.
Yeah,
promises broken.
Sure. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that's an old property law teacher. Anything like the Locke and the argument about utility and usefulness is just a rationalization that covers up plain old military force. We've got bigger guns than you've got, and we're more powerful. Nearly every property system in the world starts with somebody who had the force to drive others off and take it.
Yeah,
exactly. It's such a kind of a cynical view, but that's
It's exactly what David Ben-Gurion said. Yeah, exactly that, in fact, if I can find find that quote. Let's see. What happened was, and this is also with the Bedouin, and this is happening like literally right now. There's a Bedouin village that we'll be visiting in about a week that it has been threatened with destruction. It's been torn down like a dozen times. And there's one schoolhouse that's standing, essentially. And there are international visitors that are there guarding it. So going back to 1930s, David Van Buren has been thinking about this. What he wrote was, we must expel the Arabs and take their place. If we are compelled to use force in order to guarantee our right to settle there, our force will enable us to do so.
A force what?
Our force will enable us to do so. I mean, they'll be able to do, I'm just echoing exactly what you said. Yeah, there's a quote from Golda Meir, who was prime minister, that to me sums up so much of this. She says something like, we will never forgive the Arabs for forcing us to treat them the way we treat them.
Oh, nice.
Talk about victim trauma.
Wow.
We will never forgive the Arabs for forcing us to treat them. Well, if they had just left, we wouldn't have had to do what we have done. Yes, it's astonishing. Yeah.
Good question.
Yeah.
You can help me with my biblical history, but couldn't the Palestinians claim that they were descendants of Abraham too,
sure,
of Ishmael, and didn't God bless Hagar and
sure,
Ishmael? And
yeah.
How come that doesn't count?
I mean, it's a long story, and I don't know if Wes wants to get into it. We don't have much time.
I'm sure there's no promise of land.
Right.
There's blessing, but there's no
promise of land.
Okay.
Right, yeah. The promise of land is given to.
I don't want to throw a stone in your pebble in your pool here if it's distracting. But have you ever thought about Genesis 23 in relation to this?
Say more.
So what I find fascinating about the whole thing is that the promise to Abraham in chapter 15, like so many of the promises to Genesis are like, okay, there's a promise, but like, how is it going to happen? Like, how is this land? And Genesis doesn't say, it doesn't have the Deuteronomy thing, you must conquer them at all. And so in Genesis 23, Sarah's dead, and Abraham is faced with her dead body in the hot sun and has to deal with it. And he negotiates a contract with the Hittites.
Right.
The Hittites, of course, are one of those peoples in Deuteronomy 7 that says we will clear out.
Yeah.
So I think Genesis 23 is a counter-narrative to the Deuteronomy story that says, proposes, like, what if we just negotiate a deal with them?
Right.
Instead of taking my force, what would happen if we just agreed to buy it from them on their terms?
Right.
And in that story,
It's
totally Hittite terms. It's like highway robbery. Like, we know you got a dead wife, you're gonna pay us whatever you want, whatever you need. You're a rich guy.
Yes.
Like, don't play poor on us. And so they totally play him, and he knows it. But he gets a piece of land.
Exactly. Right. And what is he using the piece of land for?
The various life. And of course it becomes the burial place that, you know, for
precisely. Precisely. Yeah, you actually touch on this in the book you're using, The Come Out. And there's something possibly questionable about the fact, you know, just the purchase, the fact that he's purchasing this land rather than, again, listening to the word, right? Waiting for that. Right? And again, we don't have time to go into it, but that location, Hebron, right, there is, of course, a very famous temple, /temple mosque, in Hebron, right? The stones, the foundation stones of that place go back to Herod the Great. I've been there a couple of times. They are massive, massive stones. It's an amazing place. And it is there because, you know, supposedly Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah buried there. Well, it's not a coincidence that Hebron was the first place, really, that, you know, religious settlers, really fanatical religious settlers, came to Hebron in 1968, right, apparently to visit. There's only about maybe a dozen of them, and then refused to leave. We are staying. This is our land.
This is our place. Right? The government's response was not to remove them, but to support them. And Hebron has become one of the most difficult places in all of the West Bank. If you visit Hebron, the Market Street of Hebron, right, the Palestinian Market Street, is covered with wire mesh above it. Because the Israeli settlers on both sides throw refuse down on the Palestinians. The Israeli defense force is there to protect the settlers. Right? And not, well, I mean, so Hebron has become this really loaded place.
So they're protecting the settlers that are throwing the...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They're there to protect the settlers. Yeah. So the settlers have pretty much carte blanche.
Who put up the wire mesh?
Palestinian people. Yeah. And so Hebron is a microcosm, really, of the situation. Yeah. I'll just finish with this, since we're also talking about this link to America. And I'm sort of circling back to this idea of this vision of promised land. I'm going to read a couple of sentences and then pause. See how this is the quiz for the late afternoon. So how familiar is this language? Most of the Big Shore places were closed now. There were hardly any lights except the shadowy, moving glow of a ferry boat across the sound. And as the moon rose higher, the inessential houses began to melt away until gradually I became aware of the old island here that flowered once for Dutch sailors' eyes, a fresh green breast of the New World. This is?
New York.
What text? This is the Great Gatsby. This is his show. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So again, if you know that story, you know, Gatsby, just this vision of this girl really that drives him. Right. But that becomes a metaphor in some ways for this desire of a young man who has nothing to make it, to own, to possess, to live out some vision of a promise. And Fitzgerald uses that as an image for who we are as a people, going all the way back to the original settlers, right? Dutch sailor, this fresh green breast of the New World, feminizing that land. Yeah. It's vanished trees, the trees that made way for Gatsby's house, that once pandered in whispers to the last and greatest of all human dreams, for a transitory enchanted moment, man must have held his breath in the presence of this continent, compelled into an aesthetic contemplation he neither understood nor desired, face to face, for the last time in history, with something commensurate to his capacity for wonder. Fitzgerald is capturing beautifully, I think, that feeling, right, of this possibility, right, going back to Springsteen. Right, there was this place that it can exist. And when Fitzgerald writes, it's vanished trees, well, the Israelis, to take Palestinian land, planted trees as a way of claiming, you know, vacant land. In this country, it was the opposite. There were forests all over the east. Right? And what the settlers did was they chopped down the trees, they deforested, set up boundaries, set up, you know, demarcations for ownership. And the Native Americans, right, that was land where they hunted, they lived in those territories. So they pushed farther and farther away. So this is how Fitzgerald concludes this. As I sat there brooding on that old unknown world, I thought of Gatsby's wonder when he first picked out the green line at the end of Daisy's dock. He had come a long way to this blue lawn, and his dream must have seemed so close that he could hardly fail to grasp it. He did not know that it was already behind him. Somewhere back in that vast obscurity beyond the city, where the dark fields of the Republic rolled on under the night. Fitzgerald is a Midwesterner, right? In Minnesota. Right? So he's also thinking about that whole continent that's out there beyond New York. Gatsby believed in the green light, the orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther, and one fine morning. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. Boats against the current. This idea, this vision, this desire we have. So that's one understanding. And it's a failed vision, finally, for Gatsby. It's a failed vision. And we're living in the midst of that question, I think. Is it a failed vision? And it feels like it's a tender moment, let's just say. Tender moment. So that's why I want to keep coming back to this. You know, what is it in the idea that's worth continuing to try to live into, you know, what Springsteen felt, you know, at that inauguration, what truth he heard in, you know, Bob Dylan. So what is it that we can hang on to? All right, that's the bell. Thank you. We'll continue on Wednesday with Moses and the Exodus.